Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in! Happy International Women's Day today.
Yes, such a good upload day.
This will be going live for you all listeners on International Women's Day. Thank you for celebrating with us.
Yes.
Emma and I are both on vacation at the moment as well.
But if you are in for another little treat today, you can also catch us on the Hippie Hour today.
Yes, Trish invited us on to do a little set with her. We picked some songs. We talked about why we picked them. We had such a great time hanging out with a like-minded individual, spotlighting worthy and talented ladies. So after you're done here, if you're listening on upload day, you can catch us on 99.3 WBTV from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Or if you're out of range of Burlington, Vermont stations, 99.3WBTV.org will be streaming the show live. If you couldn't catch us at those times and places, no problem. The show will be archived on Mixcloud.
I'm so excited. We had the best time.
I can't believe I
pulled all that. That was so good. You had all the numbers, everything ready to go.
So how has your vacation been?
Mixed, to say the least. No, it's been pretty good, actually. The only thing was that my son has never been sick, and he's almost two. So I always felt like one day, obviously, he'll get sick. Kids get sick. Mm-hmm. But then, unfortunately, he got sick about 5 minutes before we arrived here.
Oh, no.
And so he was feeling really bad the first night, but he was fine the next morning. It was just like that one night that was a little hard, but other than that, it's pretty great. We're on a ranch.
Oh,
so amazing. They have one goat, and the goat lives in like the area with about 10 horses, and they all just live together happily, and then they have a bunch of ducks. It's so nice here. Feels very McCartney family farm here.
Yeah.
And that's so lovely. It's wonderful. We're right on the outskirts of like the big mountains. Wherever you look, it's beautiful and snow-covered mountains, but it's still quite warm and sunny. It's so wonderful. We just basically spend all our time outside.
Oh, I love that. I'm so glad your vacation is turning up after your first little bump.
I think it'll be pretty great all in all.
We just hit over 100 inches of snow at
wild.
The ski places. But I don't ski, so that doesn't mean much to me. What means much to me is the 12-foot snowbank.
Wow.
When you're plowing snow, it all has to go somewhere. My grandpa joked that we'll be having snowball fights till Memorial Day.
I don't ski either, but there's not that much snow left here. But so many tourists are here, and my in-laws who I'm here with, this is like their annual skiing vacation.
Aww.
So they're just happy that at least on top of the mountains, all the slopes are still open.
Mm-hmm. Slopes, that's the word that I couldn't figure out. Oh gosh, let's get this episode going before I forget any more words. And let's start this episode with a song. Took one look at you, and it was plain to see you were my destiny.
With arms open wide, I threw away my pride. I sacrificed for you, dedicate my life to you. I'll go where you lead.
Come on, babe.
Always there in time of need.
When I lose my will, you'll be there to push me up the hill. No, no. The song you just heard is You're All I Need to Get by Marvin Gaye and this week's doll, Tammy Terrell. The song has been sampled by Janet Jackson, LL Cool J, Method Man, and Mary J. Blige, even Biggie. Tammy Terrell was the sweetheart of Motown, singing some of the most iconic duets in pop music history. Her story has just as many happy moments as it does sad. So many people watched her suffer and either didn't or couldn't help her. Through it all, I hope you'll be moved by her talent, resilience, work ethic, and soul. Though Tammy's life was short, as her sister Ludie Montgomery asserts, it was fully realized. Today's episode is based on Unsung's episode about Tammy, available on Peacock in the US, and the book My Sister Tommy, The Real Tammy Terrell, by Ludie Montgomery and co-author Vicky Wright. It features a foreword by Ms. Dionne Warwick, extensive quotes from Tammy's friends, family photos, art, and fan mail. It reads like sitting around the table with your aunt as she pulls out family photo albums, lovingly telling you the story behind each one. You can tell how healing of an experience writing this was for Ludie. Vicky handled Tammy's life with such care. Love for her pours from every page. We'd like to issue a brief warning before going further into this episode. We will be discussing instances of domestic abuse and childhood sexual assault. If these are especially sensitive for you, we recommend you skip this week's episode. Please take care of yourselves. We'll see you again real soon.
Thomasina Montgomery, or Tommy for short, was born on April 29, 1945 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to Thomas and Jenny Montgomery. Both had moved from South Carolina as part of the Great Migration, when children and grandchildren of former slaves went north to seek work. The son of a sharecropper, Thomas was a prominent figure in Philadelphia's black community. The Montgomerys were well off thanks to his many business ventures. He owned and operated his own barber shop, ran a bed and breakfast on the Jersey Shore, rented spare rooms of the family home, and managed his brother, world champion boxer Bob Montgomery. Before settling down, Jenny was an actress. While Thomas was extroverted, driven, and a high achiever, Jenny was a sensitive, introverted artist type. Both husband and wife were college educated, and Jenny owned property with her family. This was extremely rare for single black women in the 1940s. The Montgomerys truly embodied the idea of black excellence. This was both Thomas and Jenny's second marriage. Neither had children from their previous relationships. Tommy was their first, born into a loving and prosperous home. 5 years later, her little sister Ludie arrived. The two sisters were very close in their youth. Tommy was always the ringleader, orchestrating plays and play weddings. She liked to play pranks, too. If they went sideways, she'd find a way to blame Ludie. Typical sister things. One night, she pulled her lamp under the covers so she could stay up past her bedtime reading. The lamp lit her pillow on fire. She tried to blame that on Ludie, too. Clearly, it didn't work. Peace in the Montgomery home didn't last long. For Jenny's whole adult life, she suffered from terrible headaches. When Tommy was young, she saw her mother suddenly collapse in the family home. Somehow, doctors concluded her symptoms to be from depression. In reality, she'd had an aneurysm. Jenny was institutionalized for several months and subjected to electroshock treatment. This is a sad reality of the history of women's health. Many doctors simply ignored female patients' symptoms and diagnosed them with conditions like hysteria. Afterwards, they'd be subject to cruel and unnecessary procedures for disorders they didn't have. On top of that, black women historically experience medical discrimination. This lasts even today. According to Boston University, while black women are less likely to develop breast cancer, they are 40% more likely to die if they do. Black patients continually not being listened to by white doctors has bred their distrust in modern medicine. Ludie speaks about this in her book. Several of Tommy's relatives refused to ever see a doctor. While Jenny was institutionalized, Tommy's aunt Alice stepped in to raise her and Ludie. They all soon moved to Jenny's property in Germantown. It should have been a lovely move, but Tommy was terribly sad. Since their dad worked so much and their mother wasn't around, the girls were lonely. They never spoke in depth about their mother's illness. Ludie turned inwards to cope, while Tommy buried her pain by turning outwards.
About her father and sister, Ludie said, quote, "Both Daddy and Tommy had to be out there with everyone and be where the action was. They had to be seen and stand on center stage at all times." As for Tommy, she literally had to be center stage. Soon, a chance encounter showed her to her life's purpose. One day, she saw a big black Cadillac with autographs all over it. It was Fats Domino's limousine on the way to the Uptown Theater. He'd just arrived for a week of shows with Mickey and Sylvia. Being the courageous little girl she was, Tommy brought herself and her sister right to the theater to meet Mickey and Sylvia. They tried to sneak in through the back door, but Sylvia herself caught them. Tommy wasn't about to give up. She turned on the waterworks. She cried, "Please don't tell security, our daddy will whip us blue!" Sylvia took pity on the girls, inviting them backstage to meet Mickey and Fats Domino. When it was time for the girls to run along home, Tommy said, "I'm going to be a star." Ludie emphasized this in Tammy's Unsung episode. Quote, "She decided that she, without a doubt, was going to be a star. Not an entertainer, but a star. Little did she know she'd grow up to be a duet partner just like Sylvia." Love is strange. Lot of people take it for a game. Once you get it, you never wanna quit. No, no. After you've had it, you're in an awful fix. Little Tommy sang to anyone who'd listen. Family, friends, and everyone in the neighborhood. She'd stand on a box and sing in the yard. Both girls attended Sunday school. Though Tommy didn't totally understand the significance of church yet, she won awards for singing in the choir. Thomas wasn't supportive of her dream to be a singer. Being in the boxing world, he knew show business was full of unsavory characters. He pushed for her to become a doctor instead. Jenny was the supportive one of the two parents. She enrolled both daughters in ballet and piano lessons. Tommy took to both like a duck to water. She did not care about the history of music, her piano teacher Susan Ford said. She played by ear, and that was all she cared to do. She was a great student, but I learned that I had to teach her vocally only instead, and put piano aside. End quote. Tommy learned all the doo-wop hits, as well as jazz songs by Billie Holiday, Sarah Vaughan, and her very favorite singer, Ella Fitzgerald. Tommy honed her ability to a remarkable degree. She could transcribe songs by ear. Instead of preparing songs for talent shows, she asked the audience what they wanted to hear. Even at such a young age, she already carried herself like a professional. This discipline would be good for long days and nights at Motown, but we're still a long way from that. Tommy isn't even 10 years old yet.
Tommy's family tried their best to shield the harsh realities of life from her and her sister. 1955 was the year Rosa Parks was jailed for refusing to give up her bus seat to a white man. The civil rights movement kicked off and Thomas got involved. His political interests kept him away from the home. Meanwhile, Jenny was in poor health. 1955 was also the first summer Thomas sent the girls away to their grandparents' farm in South Carolina. When they first arrived at the train station to meet their Aunt Hattie, they wandered into the whites-only entrance of a restaurant. The chef rushed them out. On the way to the farm, Hattie and the girls were called racial slurs by white men. Having come to the Jim Crow South from a wealthy black community in Pennsylvania, this was the first time Tommy and her sister experienced blatant racism. Late in the girls' second summer, they encountered a family whose daughter had starved to death. The father had abandoned the family, taking all their livestock with them. Ludie remembered, quote, "What we gathered from the entire stay in Sumter became ingrained in us forever. The lessons were to value each and every person you meet. Speak up for yourself, value each meal, and respect the hand that prepared it. We became grateful. No longer did we look at life through rose-colored glasses." Tommy became hyper-independent to cope with what was going on at home. She kept singing, performing in talent shows, and getting lead roles in school plays. When Jenny was well, she was Tommy's momager. But in the winter of 1956, Jenny collapsed again. She was only institutionalized for a few weeks at this time, but once again, her medication was for depression and not headaches. That same winter, while walking home from a rehearsal, Tommy was raped by a group of older boys. 11-year-old Tommy got herself to the police station and identified the boys who attacked her. Thankfully, they were caught and punished. But it didn't ease Tommy's mind. She didn't leave the room she shared with her sister for weeks. The family never spoke of the incident, let alone about sex. Quote, "There was no birds and the bees discussion in our home," Ludi said. "I learned the hard way, and Tommy learned the horrific way." In time, Tommy, quote, "tucked her pain deep inside and carried on with her life, using her bright and bubbly personality as a shield. She hid her pain with a smile." Ludi said that Tommy's rape was the catalyst for her complicated relationships with men. Instead of rejecting men completely, she sought their approval. Ludi described Tommy becoming rebellious, quote, "certain aspects of Tammy's personality kind of metamorphosized into extremes. She snuck out with older boys to drink, smoke, and go to nightclubs much earlier than her peers did. This behavior continued into her last summer on the farm. She constantly pushed the envelope with what was acceptable with adults. This was how she dealt with having to grow up too fast. Throughout her life, Tommy was often unfairly judged for how she coped with what happened to her." Grace defended her cousin's trauma response, saying, quote, "Women do become very promiscuous because they feel that that's what's expected of them, because they've accepted all of the guilt from the individual that has raped them." My heart honestly breaks for her. Having to go through that must be so traumatizing. And I'm also so impressed with her because I feel like this could have been a point in her life where she gave up and decided that she did not want to put herself out there at all. Mm-hmm. But she kind of like turned this around and tried to make the best out of it. And I think that that is very impressive, especially of an 11-year-old.
She made the best of a horrible situation. When she started junior high, Tommy began her transformation. Like most 12-year-old girls, she started experimenting with makeup and clothes, including a sheer blouse she got suspended from school for wearing. Both of us were 12-year-old girls at one time. Yes. I feel like we all kind of pushed the envelope like that in some way.
Yes. I went to an all-Catholic girls' school, and my head teacher was a nun, and she was like 70, and she had joined the convent when she was like 13. And so she was really, really strict. And I remember every year, as it was getting warmer, she would get on the speaker, and she would say something along the lines of,
"Please cover up, this isn't a pool."
And they would, it was so funny because I don't think she meant it to be funny, but it was unintentionally so funny, and everyone was looking forward to that great, great announcement every year.
Tommy was always pretty. Clear, warm-toned skin, big eyes, and a beauty mark over her lip. Now her body was changing. At just 13 years old, she found she had the figure of an adult woman. She got a lot of attention from boys. She always had a ride to school and someone to take her out. This part was funny in the book because when these guys from her school, they would call her house at all hours of the day trying to ask her out. And they would show up to ask her in their cars to ask her out on dates. It was just too much for Tommy. She would tell Ludi, "Go make them go away." So she would send Ludi out. This is such an older sister thing. She would send Ludi outside to kind of throw all of the boys out
clear
of
the street. Yeah.
While Tommy may have struggled internally, she thrived socially. Such a social butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy sang in all the talent shows she could. When Thomas bought the bed and breakfast on the Jersey Shore and moved his family out there for the summer, she sang at sock hops and boardwalk juke joints. She cut her hair short for the first time. In the spring of 1958, when she was 14, she saw Tammy and the Bachelor, starring Debbie Reynolds. She decided the name Tommy was too tomboyish for her. Instead, she asked to be called Tammy. Her family still called her Tommy, but now the rest of the world would know her as Tammy Montgomery. She formed girl group The Sherrys, but they didn't really go anywhere, and she soon left. Tammy also started having strong headaches like her mom. They often kept her home from school. Doctors assumed they were a symptom of eye strain, so she got glasses. When Tammy was barely 15 years old, she landed her first record deal with Scepter Records. She was still in high school and already had a career. That's amazing. As Ludi described, quote, "One day, while I was busy struggling with my math homework, I heard a screech resonating from the bedroom, then another. Tommy ran out screaming at the top of her lungs. I think the whole neighborhood heard it.
Mm-hmm.
At just 16, Tammy's first single, If You See Bill, was played on the radio.
Just tell him I still love him.
In the summer of 1962, Tammy and her mother drove down to Wildwood, New Jersey, so she could audition for Steve Gibson and the Redcaps. She got a part in their show. Finally, Thomas conceded to his daughter's desire to perform. It was her first summer of real show business, and she had her work cut out for her. She played two shows a night, every night, for the whole summer, plus matinees on the weekends. This was as many as 16 shows a week. The grown-ups in the show taught Tammy stage poise, grace, and manners. Though she sounded like a woman when she sang, she still acted like a teenage girl. She was still in school, after all, juggling cheerleading and an active social life with her career. She mostly took gigs on weekends and holidays, devoting weekdays to school. If she had to miss class, she took night courses to make them up. Tammy lived a double life: cheerleader by day, working musician by night.
One night in Wildwood, headliner Etta James invited Tammy on stage to sing with her. They tore the house down. News of this spontaneous number made it all the way out to Atlantic City and the godfather of funk himself. It turns out James Brown was a friend of Tammy's uncle Bob Montgomery. In 1963, Tammy recorded two songs by James for his Try Me record label, I Cried and If You Don't Think. It's not entirely clear how she got out of her contract with Scepter, but before along, Tammy Montgomery was in the James Brown Review. Tammy toured with James for about 8 months. She was still in high school, so she brought her homework with her on the road. She refined her voice and stage presence on tour, singing standards like My Funny Valentine and Misty.
Look at me, I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree, and I feel like I'm clinging to a cloud I can't understand. I get misty just holding your hand.
When she performed at the Apollo Theater in New York, her family came to see. She was so professional, they hardly recognized her. They were so proud. James totally spoiled Tammy, buying her even more clothes. They put her up in a swanky hotel suite. He even hired her a glam squad for daily facials, manicures, and hairdos. What 17-year-old girl wouldn't want her own glam squad? This was how James groomed Tammy. She had just turned 18 in the summer of 1963 while James was in his 30s. Their relationship was intense, with James laying hands on her multiple times. Tammy tried to quit to escape him, but her contract prevented it. One night, after she didn't watch his whole performance from backstage, James brutally beat her. Gene Chandler, the Duke of Earl, witnessed it. Tammy pleaded for Gene to buy her a bus ticket home. He instead called her mother to pick her up at once. He wanted to make sure Tammy got home safe. She left Try Me and signed with Checker Records. A duet with Jimmy Radcliffe, If I Would Marry You, flopped. When Tammy came home, quote, she looked disheveled, tired, and just worn out. As Jenny unpacked her daughter's suitcase, she found a blue silk kimono James bought for her. It was stained with blood from when he beat her. Thomas inevitably found out, revoking support of Tammy's career. He made her start pre-med courses at the University of Pennsylvania. Of course, it didn't stick. Tammy knew what she wanted to do with her life, and no man was going to stop her. Soon after Tammy came home, Thomas left for Washington, D.C. He let the Black Ward
Leaders Association to the historic March on Washington. Tammy and Ludi watched it on TV. They saw Joan Baez, Stevie Wonder, and Bob Dylan perform, and Martin Luther King's iconic I Have a Dream speech. Quote, "He made us so proud to be African American," Ludi said. Tammy watched as much as she could. She had to rest before her show that night. Like she had done with her childhood sexual assault, Tammy hid her pain with a smile. She bounced back from her abusive relationship with James Brown, returning to her nightly gig with Steve Gibson. Then she sang for Jerry the Iceman Butler's variety show.
I miss the old school rock and roll nicknames.
Like, it's so cool.
Gene the Duke of Earl, Jerry the Iceman.
She had to drop out of college to do it. Thomas was deeply disappointed. Through singing with Jerry, Tammy first performed in Detroit, Michigan, home of Motown Records. Berry Gordy established Motown in 1959. His idea was to automate the music business like Detroit's auto factories with precision and high quality. He succeeded. Berry manufactured the image of all his stars, changing names and assigning personas like the Hollywood studio system did in the 1930s, starting with their first number one, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles Shop Around. Just about every single Motown released in the 60s was a hit. Motown succeeded in bringing Black American culture to the masses. Anyone who was anyone worked for Motown, and that's exactly what Tammy wanted. She knew the path to stardom was through Motown.
You have an entire video about Motown Records.
Yes. I was so fascinated by the way that Berry Gordy planned every single career. Like, he had vocal coaches, he had choreographers, he had someone to style them, to take care of their hair. Every detail was fully planned, but it really helped to bring Black American culture and music into the mainstream. It's so fascinating. Such an incredible story.
He had a vision. I've been wanting to read his book for a minute now.
Me too. It sounds so good.
It's remarkable how little polishing he had to do with Tammy.
Yes.
In April of 1965, Berry Gordy himself discovered Tammy at the 20 Grand Club in Detroit. I'm sorry for the crackling. I am next to the fireplace right now. It's lovely, but a little noisy.
It's actually quite lovely, yes.
It wasn't hard at all for Berry to see her spectacular star power. Things moved quickly from there. She was signed to Motown on her 20th birthday, April 29th, 1965. Like he did with many of his stars, Berry changed Tammy's name. Tammy Montgomery became Tammy Terrell. This new surname has caused much confusion. People thought she was married to boxer Ernie Terrell or related to Gene Terrell of the Supremes. In Tammy's first session at Hitsville, she recorded I Can't Believe You Love Me. By Johnny Bristol and Harvey Fuqua, it was Tammy's first hit. Johnny described working with Tammy, quote, "She never complained about anything given to her. She was a great person to work with. She was easygoing and never demanding. Although a perfectionist and a hard worker, she was a lot of fun and we had many laughs." She quickly settled into life at Motown and inevitably found a boyfriend. For every teen girl who loved the Temptations, lead singer David Ruffin was their dream man. Tall, dark, and handsome, he was classy, he was charming, he could dance, and his falsetto made girls in the audience scream. Tammy couldn't help but be attracted to him. Tammy and David got to know each other as part of the Motown Review, a Motown package tour with the Supremes, the Temptations, Stevie Wonder, Shorty Long, and ventriloquist Willie Tyler. David liked Tammy's strong personality. She wasn't afraid to challenge him. He totally swept her off her feet. Instead of riding the tour bus with the guys, David got a limousine, especially for him and Tammy. The couple quickly moved into a stylish apartment together. Ludi was shocked by how luxurious it all was when she visited, and that her sister was dating a Temptation. David pulled out all the stops for Ludi's first visit. He picked her up in a limousine and cooked them all dinner. He was every bit the older sister's charming boyfriend. At her gig the next night, Tammy blew lots of kisses and mouthed, "I love you," to David from the stage. They were absolutely smitten. Behind closed doors, they had a complicated relationship. David was addicted to drugs and often had outbursts Tammy would have to quell. "Ruffin was Ruffin," Temptations member Otis Williams said. "He could be a sweetheart one minute, and then it was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde." Being that both were Motown sex symbols of the day, they constantly vied for each other's attention. David got jealous over the attention from men that Tammy got. Likewise, Tammy would have to chase away girls that turned up at their home. It was actually through one of these incidents that Tammy met her best friend Dolores. Dolores was friends with David. He'd asked her to pick up a set of sheets for him and drop them off at his place. Tammy answered the door. Remembering their interaction, she said to Dolores, quote, "Do you know the only reason I did not whoop your ass?" It's because out of all the girls that turned up looking for David, Dolores was the only one who treated Tammy with respect. They'd be friends for the rest of her life. As a friend, Tammy was loyal, fun, and every bit the girl's girl, even telling Dolores to dump a fiancé she didn't like. But not all the girls were as nice. They'd harass Tammy, picking fights and pulling her hair. The invasions of privacy were constant, but she weathered it all for her love, David. Things were looking up when he surprised her with a marriage proposal. Of course, she accepted. But once again, trouble arrived. Tammy excitedly announced her engagement on stage. Come to find out, not only did her fiancé have another girlfriend, he had a wife and 3 children.
This is so insane.
That is foul.
That is so wild. There's no way. And yet he still decided to propose to her.
Yeah, why would you buy a diamond ring knowing you are married to someone else?
I don't even know what to say about that. I cannot comprehend how that must have felt like for her.
It's baffling. Tammy was completely blindsided. Trying to save face, she still flaunted her engagement ring. We've posted a few photos to our Instagram where this ring is very visible. But the last 2 months of their relationship were marked by constant arguing. There are many salacious rumors about their relationship, including David attacking Tammy with a machete, with a hammer, her attacking him, and him abusing her dog. The violent end of their relationship, though, is confirmed. At a hotel in Atlantic City, Tammy and David had another loud argument over his marriage. When the shouting suddenly stopped, Tammy's Aunt Doris rushed to the room. David had hit Tammy in the face with his motorcycle helmet. When Doris called Tammy's parents to come get her, David climbed out the window and sped away on his motorcycle. Remarkably, Tammy held no ill will towards him. He let her keep the ring, and they remained friends for the rest of her life.
Some people are just too good.
Mm-hmm.
It's admirable that she did not hold a grudge, but on the other end,
she had every reason to hate the guy, and she didn't.
Yes. Tammy's heartache wouldn't last long. Soon she'd meet the man who'd change her life forever. In the beginning of 1967, Marvin Gaye was one of Motown's rising stars. With his smooth voice and charming persona, he had massive potential. He had a handful of hits for Motown, including Ain't That Peculiar, I'll Be Doggone, and How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You. He recorded the duets album with Kim Weston, but it underperformed. Meanwhile, Tammy's solo single struggled. Seeing both artists could benefit from each other, Berry Gordy assigned Marvin and Tammy to record a duets album. Harvey Fuqua and Johnny Bristol were brought on to produce. Husband and wife duo Nicholas Ashfold and Valerie Simpson were assigned to write the songs. Barely a week later, on January 6th of 1967, Tammy went to Hitsville to record her vocals for the first song. It wasn't supposed to be a duet at first. It just sort of happened that way. Marvin dubbed his vocals in later that month. It would be released in June, and by July it would peak at number 3 on the Billboard R&B chart. That song, of course, was Ain't No Mountain High Enough.
That song is pure magic.
It's so good.
I can't get enough. It's top to bottom, the production, mm-hmm. the lyrics, what they're singing about, and Marvin and Tammy's performances themselves.
Their voices.
Such amazing chemistry.
Mm-hmm. They really did. Their voices blend so well. Tammy and Marvin took America by storm. They became one of the country's premier duos, never one without the other. They went on tour. They appeared on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. They even recorded a Coca-Cola jingle together. Their first album together, United, was released in August of 1967, featuring Ain't No Mountain, Your Precious Love, and Abby's personal favorite, a recording of Something Stupid. That's just such a good song.
Mm-hmm.
With her tucked under his arm, Tammy and Marvin looked less like Prince and Princess of Motown and more like a real couple. It was as if Ashfold and Simpson wrote about them. Quote, "People felt it," Valerie Simpson said. "We realize now, after the letters we get, just how many romances and babies were made from the music." Though they had chemistry like no other, they could never be together. Marvin's wife, Anna, was Berry Gordy's sister. If he were to divorce her, he'd effectively end his career. When talking to his biographers, Marvin asserted their relationship was strictly platonic. Quote, "I could sing to a real-life woman in the studio. I trained myself for the part with Mary Wells and Kim. When Tammy came along in 1967, I had the role mastered," Marvin said to biographer David Ritz. At the very least, Marvin was Tammy's closest friend at Motown. Even after all the trauma she endured, she still trusted blindly. Marvin understood this and treasured her devotion. He protected her as best as he could. Meanwhile, Tammy brought shy Marvin out of his shell. Ashford and Simpson wrote about their own love. Marvin and Tammy happened to interpret those lyrics beautifully. As it always seemed to be with Tammy, this triumph in her life was undercut by tragedy. In October of 1967, Tammy was on a busy college tour with Marvin. The headaches she'd had since she was a teen were getting worse, but she wrote it off as stress. While singing Your Precious Love at Hampton Sydney College in Virginia, Tammy suddenly collapsed in Marvin's arms. He immediately stopped the show and carried her off stage. She was sent home to Philly to recover. Doctors were stumped. It seemed Tammy suffered an aneurysm like her mother. But after extensive testing, a malignant tumor was found in Tammy's brain. It was in that part of the brain that controls fine motor skills, explaining her stroke-like symptoms. While she was in the hospital, Motown released the third single from United, If I Could Build My Whole World Around You. Fans and colleagues alike showered Tammy with love as she headed into her first surgery in January of 1968. Though a temporary fill-in was hired to complete the college tour, Marvin stayed with Tammy after her surgery, not once leaving her side.
Tammy's first operation appeared to be a success. She assumed she was cured. She underwent a second surgery in early 68 to put tubes in her head. The location of the tumor blocked spinal cord fluid from draining on its own. Then she returned to Detroit. She now wore long wigs to hide the scar on her head and was hyper aware of her surroundings as not to accidentally bump her head. Though she was fragile, she insisted upon recording more. Sessions began for Tammy and Marvin's second album, You're All I Need, that year. Harvey, John, Nick, and Valerie reassembled. Rumors have swirled over the years that Tammy was too sick to sing on her last few albums. This is only partly true. Marvin's friend Lou Van Demps, who was in Hitsville during You're All I Need sessions, said, quote, "Tammy was working so closely with Valerie. She gave her all, and she showed up and tried. They were together on it. Tammy is singing, and Valerie helped her to make this happen. That was the greatest gift that Valerie could give to Tammy because she knew, we all knew, how important it was for Tammy to finish the work." Nick and Valerie later clarified in Tammy's 2010 Unsung episode that Valerie would record demo vocals, which Tammy would later re-record. As far as the overdubbing goes, "It was blown out of proportion over the years," Johnny Bristol said. Val helped her vocally to get through those sessions. There was nothing to it, and everyone agreed that Tammy would complete them one day. She did complete them, and You're All I Need was released in August of 1968. It produced two more smash hits, You're All I Need to Get By and Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing. I saw your face when I mentioned that last one.
It's such a good song. It is so, so good.
both did even better than Ain't No Mountain High Enough, hitting number one on the R&B charts. America couldn't get enough of their favorite singing partners. Sadly, Tammy's sickness prevented her from promoting the record like she wanted. She was hospitalized again. Most of her days were spent nursing her headaches. Her medication made her nauseous. By the end of the year, she'd had more surgeries to remove tumor growth and drain fluids. Never once did she lose hope. She even continued signing autographs for fans upon her insistence. Because she was still partially paralyzed on one side, and the tumor affected her motor skills, most of her writing from that time was just scribbles. Through the end of 1968 and beginning of 1969, Tammy's condition improved. She made another trip out to Detroit to record her third and final album with Marvin, Easy. Marvin claimed that most of Tammy's vocals on Easy were in fact by Valerie Simpson. She has denied this. In truth, it's hard to say what is Tammy singing and what isn't on Easy. Some of it sounds like her. I'll be honest, some songs really don't. It's impossible to gauge what could have been affected by Tammy's voice possibly changing through her treatment. Mm. She underwent physical therapy to regain her mobility. Her treatment included swimming. She was also prescribed plenty of rest and vacations to the Bahamas. Tammy was even less involved in promoting Easy than she was for You're All I Need. She underwent more surgeries. There were even rumors that she died. I think it was unfair for people to look to Motown for answers, Ludi said. They were protecting Tommy. The record label was not the source to speak to concerning something so personal. I think this added mystery to what was going on, but it was simply a private matter for our family. Tammy sat for a rare interview for Ebony magazine in 1969, clearing up the rumors. In this article, Tammy claims that the stress of her relationship with, quote, the lead singer of a famous vocal group in 1966 worsened her headaches. This is clearly David. Ebony probably couldn't name him for fear of getting sued.
She was clever with these things.
Tammy also defended Berry Gordy. Quote, it's funny, but most people don't realize what a truly warm and generous man he is. Of course, they know he's very wealthy and that he owns Motown, but they don't know what kind of human being he is. If it weren't for Barry and Motown, I might not be alive today. It's true. Barry paid all of Tammy's medical bills. She made a return to singing, but it was a struggle. The tumor in her brain had started to affect her behavior. She'd get confused and lash out. Her medication made her gain weight, and she was losing her hair. Her brief return to performing remains controversial. Many, including Marvin Gaye himself, thought Motown took advantage of Tammy while she was sick. It's hard. All Tammy wanted to do was perform, but she wasn't well enough to do it anymore. Mm. Carla Thomas was eventually brought in to be Marvin's new partner. Tammy attended their show at the Apollo. She kept her cool through Ain't No Mountain, but when they started singing You're All I Need to Get By, she started loudly singing along. She was confined to a wheelchair at this point, but stood up to sing to Marvin. Partway through the song, he spotted her in the crowd. Tammy! He cried. He left Carla on stage, rushed into the audience, and finished the song with Tammy. There was not a dry eye in the place. It would be her final performance.
For me, there are two big what-ifs in this story. Mm-hmm. One that I want to talk about a little later, but one big what-if that I felt after reading the script for the first time was, what if Marvin Gaye wouldn't have been married before? Mm. Would he have been the big love of her life from everything that you wrote and everything that I read on other sources? It just seems like Marvin truly adored her and he just wanted the absolute best for her. And yes, that could be fully platonic. There are friendships that are that way. But I just kind of like, I couldn't stop wondering whether things would have been different if he wouldn't have been married. Early in 1969, Motown released Tammy's one and only solo album, Irresistible. It's a compilation of recordings she made between 1965 and 1968, including Come On and See Me.
For you, love, and
The cover spotlights her enduring passion for fashion. She wears her long wig, matching orange shoes and tights, and the psychedelic print tent dresses she'd come to favor. Also in 1969, Tammy got engaged to Dr. Ernie Garrett. They met through Marvin. He was an avid golfer, and Ernie was part of his golfing four. He was one of the first black medical doctors in New Jersey, an ambitious, strong, and smart man. The couple met at a Motown party. While the Temptations and the Supremes were living it up, Ernie was doing crossword puzzles. That is such... like, this immediately makes him likable for me.
Yes.
Tammy took an immediate interest in this handsome man that sat in the corner. Before long, she was doing crosswords to have something to talk about with him. Ernie mused about all the things he loved about Tammy. Quote, "She was so clever, intelligent, and real. She had brains and beauty. She knew some of the things about her that were being said. She did not care, and she did not play into it or deny it. Her family was very. At this point, they didn't trust her taste in men. They sent Ludi out to New Jersey to spend the weekend with them. Ernie got her approval. At last, Tammy had found a good man. He took her on road trips when she was well enough to go. Sweetest of all, he'd sing around the house with her. If she wanted to do her songs, Ernie sang Marvin's parts for her." She did find that great man.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's so sweet.
Just... mm-hmm. I don't know, my heart breaks about
the time that she got.
Yes.
It's so hard because when she signed her first record deal at 15 years old, she already has less than 9 years to live. And it's so rare to find the right person that young. It's the exception, not the rule. You guys, you and your husband, you're really the exception, not the rule.
Yeah. In the fall of 1969, Tammy's fragile health took another downturn. Her tumor had become resistant to radiation. It was clear to all around her that this was the twilight of her life. Ernie emotionally prepared to let go of his beloved fiancé. Meanwhile, Marvin confided in Louvain. Quote, "Louvain, I know she's not going to make it and there's nothing I can do." Tammy entered the graduate hospital for the final time in January of 1970. Quote, "Tommy never talked about this being the end for her," Ludi said. After an 8th unsuccessful operation, Tammy Terrell passed away on March 16th of 1970. She was just weeks shy of her 25th birthday. Her friend Dionne Warwick attempted to make sense of it all. Quote, "To have been called away so young is something that will always be a wonder, but then we cannot put a question mark where God puts a period. For many years, people have speculated that Tammy's death was caused by head trauma dealt by David Ruffin or James Brown. Her doctor, Richard Harner, has repeatedly denied this. This is the second what if that I couldn't stop thinking about. What if either she met Ernie younger, or she would have become a doctor herself? Would she or Ernie have been able to catch this earlier, and would that had a different outcome? Was there maybe a chance for her?
That's the trouble with the history of medicine.
Yeah.
Treatment just wasn't there yet. And if it was, 9 out of 10 doctors wouldn't have listened to her.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking. It honestly is. Tammy's memorial service was held at James United Methodist Church, the same church she sang at as a child. Marvin Gaye read a short but deeply moving eulogy. According to Ernie, all of Motown Records was banned from attending, save for Marvin. Ludi remembers it differently. Motown stars came out in droves to mourn. Those of her colleagues who couldn't attend sent flowers. Even Aretha Franklin sent a telegram to be read at the service. Despite the rain, the streets outside were filled with thousands of mourners. Ludi was completely overwhelmed by the show of support. Quote, "I did not understand why they came. I was astonished that thousands of people came out to say goodbye. She was my sister, and I was in complete grief and devastation. Who were these people? Why were they here? Did they love her as much as I do?" While Ludi was deeply moved, Thomas was angered by the media circus surrounding his daughter's memorial. Marvin spiraled into a deep depression as he grieved. Quote, "Tammy was the victim of the violent side of love. At least that's how it felt. It was a deep vibe, as though she was dying for everyone who couldn't find love. My heart was broken. My own marriage to Anna had proven to be a lie. In my heart, I could no longer pretend to sing love songs for people. I couldn't perform. When Tammy became ill, I refused to sing in public." Though this depressive period in part produced Marvin's greatest work, he never completely recovered from losing her. The rest of his life would be marked by drug abuse and depression. For a long time after Tammy's passing, Ludi couldn't cope. She couldn't look at family photos. Hearing her sister's songs distressed her. Meanwhile, my sister Tommy, co-author Vicky Wright, hoped to write a biography about Tammy. A number of coincidences brought the two together. Both take them as signs from God. Through much praying, Ludi was able to write My Sister Tommy. It was an incredibly healing process for her. Quote, "Now I can look through our family's history and smile. I hear her music and I feel good. I know she is with me always." In 2005, Ludi and Vicky completed a script for a biopic based on their book. It hasn't moved forward, but in 2024, My Sister Tommy was reprinted. Motown released a Tammy career retrospective called Come On and See Me, The Complete Solo Collection. It features unreleased songs as well as her songs from the Tammy Montgomery days. It brought much of her solo work to streaming services for the first time. In 2021, Black Music City posted a short film about Tammy's life called The Tammy Terrell Project. Ludi's own Tammy project is still active today.
It's impossible to escape the tragic end of Tammy's life, but we'd like to end this episode with some things about her and spotlight her achievements. Tammy's favorite color was green. It's why she wears a green dress on the cover of United. Her favorite perfume was Youth Dew by Estee Lauder. She had a dog named Beishu. She hoped to be on Broadway someday. She only owned one car in her life, a white Chevy Corvair. Despite living in the Motor City, she wasn't a very good driver. She crashed that Corvair into a tree. Besides singing, Tammy's favorite hobby was shopping. She took her mom on vacations and supported her family with earnings from her music. She never had any inclination to be a mother, instead being the beloved Aunt Tommy to Ludi's son and godmother to Ernie's goddaughters. Tammy remains an inspiration in the 21st century. In 2006, Amy Winehouse was nominated for Album of the Year for Back to Black. A single from that album, Tears Dry on Their Own, samples Ain't No Mountain. I knew I had him at my match, but every moment we get snatched. I don't know why I got so attached. It's my responsibility, and you don't own nothing to me, but to walk away, I have no capacity. He walks away, the sun goes down, he takes the day, but I'm grown, and in your way, in this blue shade, my tears dry on their own. I don't understand, what do I stress? Today, Ain't No Mountain High Enough has over 1.5 billion streams on Spotify. She was alive for just 24 years, but Tammy's voice is immortal in pop music history. As Ludi said, quote, "If anyone lived in the moment and lived life fully, I can say it was Tommy. At a young age, she knew deep in her soul who she was. She tapped into that long before most people do. Her life is an example of the power of courage. Tammy's irrepressible spirit inspires us all to live life boldly. Take that leap of faith. Make that phone call. Love openly and shine brightly. Live life to the fullest. When your innermost soul wants, there is no mountain high enough and no river wide enough to hold you back." Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the life of Motown's sweetheart, Tammy Terrell.
As always, we're Emma
and Abby,
your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to sub.
It happens.
We've been saying this for how long? If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls. And if you'd like to check out the sources we used for this episode and the songs we played, they are always listed in the show notes.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.